Good evening, and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I, of course, am Pastor Zach, and tonight we are tackling another very hot and sensitive question for our society today. Last week we took a look at the ramifications, or more specifically, the question of why do Christians take issue with homosexuality, or homosexuals, a more specific version even of that question of why do we condemn homosexuality or homosexuals. And we laid out a lot of groundwork before we ever even got into that question of setting up what the purpose is of having that particular discussion. And tonight's we're going to handle no differently than we did last week's. And, of course, tonight's question, for those of you that follow closely and saw the announcement of what we were looking at next in these long list of questions that we've put together over the last couple of years from people who were talking about having issues studying the Bible, or basically even more so just common questions that we get about the Bible and about doctrine and belief and these kinds of things, is the question of why do Christians take an issue with abortion? And so that's the question we're going to unravel tonight. And we're going to get into the ins and the outs of this, because that's kind of a poorly worded question in a lot of ways. And the reason for that being that even now, right now, in today's modern times and the times that we are dealing with currently, there is even a divide amongst Christianity, and I could have a whole nother separate conversation about that. But anyway, as to whether or not this particular thing is even a problem in the eyes of God. And so really the question probably needs to be better phrased of why is it that the Bible has an issue with abortion? Because you're running into a day and time where Christians and even religious people outside of Christianity are starting to have less and less of a problem with the practice of abortion. And so it's a better phrase that why does the Bible take an issue with it? Because whether you say that you're a child of God, you're a Christian, you're Islamic, you're Jewish, you're whether and whatever flavors of those, there's Orthodox Islam, there's, different versions of that with Sunnis and Shiites. And then if you swing over to the Jewish side of things, you have more secular Judaism and more Orthodox Judaism. Even inside of all those different groups of people, we see that there's a huge debate going on, even amongst so-called religious people or Christian people, that have to do with this question. And despite whatever arguments or debates are occurring, we need to understand that whether we like it or not, God's answer to this question is not only a very simple one, but it's one that answers negatively to the question of no, there's no grounds in which abortion is ever an okay thing. There's no grounds in which the Bible allows for it. There's no grounds in which God's people should be okay with it. And we're going to talk about why, and we're going to look at this from all the angles, because I don't think that this is a question that really even requires that I open a Bible and make an argument from a place of authority that a lot of other people are not going to recognize anyway. There's times that Christians, we kind of have this wrong idea that when we have arguments such as this or discussions such as this with other people, that if we appeal to the Bible, that automatically makes us right in the eyes of other people. And that's just not the case. Because if the person I'm talking with does not believe in God, nor follow God, nor serve the God that I serve, it's already a moot point. They're gonna immediately dismiss it because they don't care about the God of the Bible or God's opinion on it. Okay? So before we tackle all that, though, I want to express to you that if you're on here tonight, you're listening to this, you are a Christian, and you're okay with abortion, okay? This is not me saying that I hate you, that I don't like you, that any of those things. This is not some personal attack on you. this is me as a pastor of the Word of God informing you of this is what the Bible says. This is what is right. This is what is right not only from a biblical perspective, but from a scientific one and from a civic one as well. There's many different arguments that exist that are very logical, very reasonable for why this is in every sense of the word wrong. If you're on here and you don't care about the God of the Bible, or you're not a Christian, or you're lost, however, whatever category of that you fit into, okay? And you've had an abortion, or you're okay with abortion, again, I want you to understand this is not me attacking you. This is not me trying to pick a fight with you. This is me explaining to you the realities of the world. Whether you accept that or not is up to you. So, as always, we want to take the Colossians principle as God's people of our goal being to inform and to better the lives of other people, not to cause further problems or issues. A better way of paraphrasing that may even be that we are slow to speak, quick to listen, and slow to wrath. That's the Colossian principle on how God's people are to have these kinds of conversations in the world. So let's start at the beginning. And the beginning meaning that I want to save the biblical answer to this question for the very end. And the reason that I want to save this for the very end is because to me, the biblical answer is the one that matters the most, because I'm a child of God and because I'm a pastor of the Word of God and because, quite frankly, God's opinion is the only opinion that I care about. And secondly, because there are many, many Christians who are struggling with this question, and I want the last thing you guys to hear, to have a focus on by the time we're done with this podcast, is on God's opinion. Because the sooner that God's people figure out what is really the answer to this question, the sooner that we can begin to deal with that question in a much more efficient and organized way. So we're going to start out with the scientific reasoning or the approach of abortion. And before you can really even have this conversation fully, you need to know what exactly an abortion is. When I've had people ask this question in the past, usually my first question is, well, before we even go down that avenue, do you know what an abortion is? Do you know what that looks like? Do you know the methodologies behind how that occurs? Do you understand what you are doing when you say you agree with that, or if you are going to go and have one of those done? I worked in the medical field for a long time. No, not as a doctor. I've worked in the insurance area, the billing side of things, assigning patients, these kinds of things. I've had my mother that I worked with doing all of that stuff has been in the medical field for literally her entire life, so about 25 to 30 years, give or take a little bit. And one of the things that's very strange for me, I guess because I come from a lot of that background, is that there are many people who do not understand even remotely what an abortion is or how those things occur or what procedures are done for it. And they really don't even know what kind of procedures and things are done for run-of-the-mill, everyday problems. There seems to be a very, very high amount of ignorance amongst the regular folk, for lack of a better way of putting it, for things that occur in the medical field. So let me tell you what abortions are, first of all, okay? And yes, this is remotely graphic. I'm going to be very blunt. I'm not trying to exaggerate the graphics of what occurs. I'm not trying to play this up or play on your emotions, but I am going to speak very bluntly because that's just who I am. So the very first option when you're dealing with a child that's somewhere in the ballpark of conception to 3 to 4 weeks, there is what is a procedure is known as a suction aspiration, which is a very fancy way of saying that a tube is placed within the mother, the child is dismembered and sucked out. And yes, I am going to refer to them as a child, because the word fetus is not understood in our community, or in, amongst the common folk, for lack of a better way of putting it, as still being a child. There's a lot of times that that word is used to disassociate with what's really occurring. And we're going to be blunt about this. We're going to call it what it is. We're not going to try to disassociate from it. We're not going to try to frou-frou it up. We're not going to try to clean it up. We're going to call it what it is, because if you're okay with this, then you need to own what it is, okay? The same way that if I was, not the same way that as I'm not okay with it, I am owning that I am not okay with it, all right? So that's the first one. Depending on how early on you have a suction aspiration where the child is literally sucked out of the mother, okay? Then, as you're moving on down a little bit further past that, mostly in the ballpark of about 4 to 8, 9 weeks, okay, give or take a little bit, you have what is referred to as a dilation and a curettage, okay, which is the cutting of the child into pieces and then removing and reassembling the child. Now, what that means is that when the child is cut up within the womb of the mother, they use long forceps to grab the individual pieces of the child, and they basically play a jigsaw puzzle outside of the mother on a metal tray to make sure that they have gotten every piece of the child. Because even though we will talk about how a child, and we have this debate as to whether or not a child is a living thing and at what point they become a living thing, if you miss one single piece of the body of the child, they will rot inside the mother, cause infection, and in a lot of ways can make the mother go septic and kill the mother, which I think is very fascinating that we'll have this debate as to whether or not this is a biological life, yet it rots and it decays like a biological life that has ended. All right? That's a little 2 cents for you. There's also a point at which, in this earlier area, that you can, there is another procedure, which is a chemical abortion. And in a chemical abortion, the mother is typically injected with saline. There's a couple of other things that can be used, but it's typically saline. And when you inject saline directly into the amniotic fluid of the womb, essentially it's like putting salt on a snail. The child literally burns to death. The body is burned to death, and it takes up to an hour for the child to die. And then either suction aspiration or the cutting up and removal of what is left of the child is what's brought into play. Then for your later ones, and these are, if you've paid any attention to the news, you've paid any attention at all to the scientific community, if you've paid any attention to the political realm in the United States, any of these things, this is the one that you are going to hear about the most. And it's referred to under two different names. There's a dilation and extraction, or it's known as a dilation and evacuation. This is the one that is very commonly talked about in the political realm. When you see people that are making a debate or an argument against abortion, this is typically the one that they are describing. And what occurs in a dilation and extraction, or a dilation evacuation, pick whichever of the two flavors you want to go with, is that an ultrasound is used, the same machine that is used to identify the child, identify the sex of the child, all these kinds of things, is used on the mother. A nurse will hold the ultrasound where the doctor can see the body of the child. The doctor will then reach in and grab a hold of the child by the lower extremities, forcibly pull the child leg first through the birth canal, of course, outside of the mother's body. At that point, a pair of scissors is used to cut an incision into the head of the child. And on these particular medical scissors, there are grips on either end in which you can cut and then push the scissors into the incision, the hole in the skull of the child. Open that up forcibly by opening the blades of those scissors. And that, of course, makes a larger hole in the skull of the child. And then the same process is basically carried out in a little bit of a different way. They will perform then a suction aspiration where they suck the brain out of the child. Basically, they kill the child. Up until the point of the brain being removed, the child is alive. They are alive. They do react. They do cry. They do scream. They do yank. They do pull away from the pain in an attempt to get away from what is causing the pain. Not playing that up for you. Just being honest. The brain is suctioned out. At that point, the child is then killed. The body, of course, is then dismembered and removed the rest of the way and reassembled to make sure that we have indeed gotten all of the body of the child. And that's the four major methods of abortion. There's a couple of other flavors in the chemical department, a couple of other flavors in the cutting up and removing, but those are the four methods. And whether we like that or not, if you're on here and you're fine with an abortion, I hope that you've taken the time to research what you approve of. Because all four of those methods, regardless of what point they occur, are not only graphic, but they are by nature all life-ending procedures. If I was to carry any of those acts out on an adult human being, it would end up in their death every single time. So for us to talk about this question of abortion from a true scientific standpoint, whether we like it or not, whether you approve of this or not, whether this matches your feelings or not, a human life, the beginning of life for any child, is the moment of conception. That's scientifically proven. That's not a debatable fact. That's not anything that's ever been debated by true scientific communities. Never been debated at all. At the moment that sperm and egg meet, we have a human being with 46 chromosomes. It has its own unique DNA structure. It has its own unique genetics. It cannot be replicated, by the way, in any way, shape, or form. It is the one and only combination. And so at that moment, we have a life, whether we like it or not. We have a life, whether that matches your feelings or your emotion or not, we have a life. And what we also know from that point, well beyond day one, is that the child is essentially fully developed, a full human being, within 16 weeks of conception. It's rapidly fast. When you look at 3 weeks after conception, we have a fetal heartbeat, we have a blood flow, and that heart is independently pumping the blood of the child. And all too often, the blood type of the child is completely different than the mother. And all of these functions are being carried out by the child's body independently. The idea that a child is similar to that of a parasite developed that's carrying on its life inside of another human, outside of a human being or another biological organism, whichever you want to pick, it's absolutely foolish. There's nothing about that at all that's even remotely the same. The parasitic relationship is one that literally is killing its host. There is no point in which a child is killing the mother actively. There might be a genetic problem with the mother. There might be a medical problem with the mother that will cause a strain to exist on the body of the mother as a result of trying to have a child. Similar situation to that would be one such as ovarian cysts. There's a lot of women, especially right now in the United States, due to the overall poor health, nutrition, and everything else that goes on in the States, that they have this condition. And with an ovarian cyst, there's a lot of pain, there's improper menstrual cycles, there's all kinds of horrible and terrible things that can happen. And most of the time, they are not able to actually have children. But there, every now and again, there's a miracle that occurs in which a woman with this kind of condition will become pregnant. And yes, it is an extraordinarily difficult pregnancy. But that's not because the child is parasitic in nature. That is because the mother's body was genetically or medically in a bad position to be able to carry a child. It has nothing to do with the child itself. The child's independent of that. So by 3 weeks, we have a heart, we have blood flow, we have independent development and pumping of that blood throughout the body of this particular child. By 5 weeks, we have eyes, we have legs, and we have hands that have developed. By the 5 week mark, that is typically when most women have realized, oh, hey, I'm pregnant. We've missed a menstrual cycle, maybe even two, depending on the woman at hand and when the conception occurred. By this point, there's definitely been a change in hormones. There's the potential for morning sickness. There's the potential for extreme amounts of exhaustion. You know, for the father of the child, he may have noticed that the mother of the child has started to get what appears to be lazy. I'm just teasing. I told my wife that, though, all the time. When we first had our first one, I said, man, you're sleeping all the time. What's wrong with you? And then we found out, okay? So by week five, you essentially have the formation and the heartbeat and all the things of a human being. They look like a very tiny little human body by week number five. And then by week number six, we have full brain activity. Brain activity that can be monitored, observed, and recorded by week number six. By 7 weeks, the child's kicking, swimming, they're moving throughout the womb and their amniotic environment. By 8 weeks in, we have all of our organs developed, that all of the organs of the child have been fully developed. The bones are taking shape, and the child has already beginning to develop fingerprints, which is a very unique identifying mark in many ways for the humans. By week number 14, we have teeth formed. We have fingernails completely developed. The child is able to turn and move their head independently. By 16 weeks, the child's able to grasp objects, and they are even beginning to take part in a REM sleep cycle, which means they have the ability to dream, they have the ability to have emotions, they have the ability to react to stimuli as much as any other human being on earth. That is not even by the halfway mark of the gestation period of a woman. So scientifically speaking on this question, there is no debate whatsoever that life begins at day one. There is no debate whatsoever that no later than 3 weeks after conception could we even make an argument that this is not a child or a living thing because of the fact that we have a human heartbeat by 3 weeks. So even if you wanted to get on here and say, well, you know, I only believe that life begins when it's observable that this is indeed a biological human being. Okay, well then you've got until 3 weeks to have an abortion. Because at that point, it is very clear that what we are dealing with is a child. Now, there is one other scientific fact, though, that a lot of people want to ignore when we get into this whole layout of this question in a big way. And that scientific fact is the maternal instinct of the mother and the recognition by the mother that they do indeed have a living child. And I know what you're probably thinking, well, what in the world does that have to do with the price of tea in China? What that has to do with it is that if it has already been statistically, numerically, and over a very large period of time, observed that in 84% of women who want to have an abortion, that if they are shown an ultrasound of their child, they immediately change their mind. Meaning that even on a biological level, if I can show you that no, despite what everybody else is telling you out here, this is what's actually going on inside of you, that instinct, that biological component of a woman's brain will 84% of the time override the ideology of the mother and proving that, yes, this is indeed a child. So when we take all of the science of this question together, the idea that an abortion is we are removing a parasite, we are removing something that is non-biologically a human, there's no actual life there yet until further into the pregnancy. It's all ascientific. It's all absolute garbage. It is in no way, shape, or form fit any of the other things that we claim to hold to, true to. If I was to ask an abortionist if they believed in the theory of evolution, I am sure they would say, oh yes, I am 100%. I agree with Darwin, whether it's a macroevolution or microevolution. I am totally certain that if I was to ask somebody who is okay with abortion, if they believe in those two things, the answer is going to be yes. Well, the very idea of macro and microevolution, and especially in macroevolution, when you look at Darwinian evolution, one of the principles of natural selection is that you have more children than available resources. So even if we look at this from any other scientific perspective, this whole idea of abortion not only being okay and in no way, shape, or form murder, or in no way, shape, or form the discarding of a biological human being, is an absolute farce. It's completely and totally foolish, because those same people would also talk about how it's important that a rabbit have a litter of 10 kits, because if, who knows, they might, five of them might die before they become an adult. These are the same people who will give you the conversation that animals should have rights in the United States, to the point that if I was to go out and grab one of my chickens and viciously kill it, you know, as opposed to dispatching it humanely for the processing of food, I'd be thrown in jail. These are the same people that if I went outside and I punched my dog all afternoon, I would be thrown in jail for the mistreatment of a life form that is well lower on the totem pole than humanity. So when we're talking about getting to this conversation, what we have to understand is that from a scientific perspective, not only is abortion the killing of a living being, but it is also ascientific to every other theory and practice in the scientific community. So the reason that I wanted to pin that down, though, is because we need to focus on where is this question really coming from. And where this question is really coming from has nothing to do with science. We already know, especially in this day and time, of a much better quality education system than has ever existed on the planet beforehand, and a day and time where men and women and children are being educated at a much higher rate and at a much better rate than they were before. And yes, that even includes with Common Core, which is an absolute joke, but it's still more education than humanity has ever experienced at any other point in human history up until this point. You have people that no matter what walk of life, whether they're poor, whether they're rich, they're all being educated on a similar level. Okay? We already know, with such an educated society, that to go and try to pull science in on that conversation is absolutely crazy, because this is not a scientific question. This is a civic and religious question by nature, because what we are essentially doing is we're trying to play off the scientific aspect of that we're dealing with a life, and the reason that we're trying to do it that way is because the moment that we look at the science of it, we know we have a life. And so we don't want to bring this question over into a legal and into a religious conversation, because that's where things start to get messy, and that's where things start to get even more brutal in answering this question. So let's talk about this from a civic point of view. And when I say a civic point of view, I mean laws and legislation, what is rational, what is right. What are the implications of accepting abortion as not as being something that is legally okay, that is rationally okay, and that is something that's going to build our society as a whole? Okay? Because that's what we're talking about. We get into civics. We're going to get God at the end of this. We're going to get the opinion that really matters at the end of this. So, first of all, the arguments behind the legality, the rationality of allowing abortion or that abortion is an okay thing to have is essentially what I call the unicorn argument. And what I mean by that is that when we pin this down and say, okay, well, why do you need an abortion? Why do you want an abortion? Why is it that this seems to be the solution to your issue? It's always some ridiculous concept such as, well, what if we had a young lady who is 15 years old? She goes out with her freshman friends to a restaurant, and there she goes into the bathroom, and some 45-year-old drunken bum creep goes into the bathroom behind her, and he beats her half to death, and then he rapes her, and then lo and behold, she's pregnant from that. What about her? First of all, that whole description there is 2% of abortion cases in the United States. No, that's not up for debate. No, that's not something that I've pulled out of my brain somewhere or pulled out of the other end of my body from somewhere. That is a statistically proven fact. The 2% of abortions have occurred as a result of a criminal activity. Meaning that when you come up with the unicorn argument for making a blanket law, that goes against rationality. I am not going to go outside and say, well, I personally suffer from eating from a peanut allergy. And no, I don't actually have one. This is just an illustration. And because I have a peanut allergy, we need to outlaw all the peanut products in the United States. That is not rational. That's not reasonable. And that is what has to be brought forward to prove the necessity of a law. It has to be rational and it has to be reasonable. It's not reasonable for me to outlaw peanut butter for 80% of the population because 20% of them swell up like a balloon if a peanut gets near them. That's not rational and it's not reasonable. So if we're going to come at this from a position of, well, we need to have abortion for everybody because of the unicorn case, because of the most Shakespearean tragic case on the planet that you can create. My answer to you is that's not rational, nor is that reasonable. Now, the next argument that usually comes is, well, it's my body, it's my choice. Which is, again, a very foolish, a very non-rational, very, very unreasonable argument. And here's why. So, first and foremost, there is all kinds of legislation about what you can and cannot do with your body. It is not legal for you to shoot your body full of heroin. Even though it's your body and it's your choice, you will still go to prison. Well, why will you go to prison for that? Well, because heroin addicts commit tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of criminal activity in the United States. Places that are full of people that have a heroin addiction then breed other crimes, prostitution, murder, gang activity. It leads to a rot and a decay in society. And no, I'm not saying that these people are undesirable. They need help with those addictions. They need help with those problems. What I am telling you is the consequences of allowing heroin or a heroin addict to do the behavior that they want to do, which is why it is legislated. You cannot do this. This is not rational, this is not reasonable, and this is not good for a society. So the idea of my body, my choice, absolutely foolish. You can't put whatever drugs you want to in your system. You cannot do whatever you want to do with your body. I can't say, well, my body is having a fleshly, lustful desire for this woman across the table from me. And since I am able to physically hold her down and overpower her, I can do what I want to with my body. That's an absolute foolish thing. So for you to say, well, it's my body and it's my choice, is the most asinine of arguments on the planet. There is so much legislation that already exists for what you can and cannot do with your body. And all of that is based on rational, reasonable, non-criminal behavior. So when we're looking at this from a civic place, the arguments that are made to try to make a blanket case for abortion is absolute foolishness. It doesn't have any withstanding whatsoever. Another good example of this is what I've already kind of caveated to a moment earlier of I can't just go outside and beat my dog from one end of the yard to the other because he made me mad today. I will go to prison for that. If I'm not allowed to mistreat somebody who is much lower on the totem pole from a human life, there's no reason in the world that I should have the right to decide what can be done with a human life within the womb of a woman. And that includes her. She doesn't have the right to make that decision. The other reason that she doesn't have the right to make that decision is because she does not have sole ownership of that child. And yes, I say ownership because that is how it is looked at legally. That who is responsible for the child? There is a man who is responsible for 50% of that individual existing. A woman does not get to decide what she's going to do with 50% of somebody else's property responsibility. And I'm not trying to diminish the life. I'm talking explicitly as to how the law would look at such a situation. Because if we're going to say that a fertilized embryo is not a living human being, that automatically brings this down to an argument of property, which is why I say that. So if I cannot in any way, shape, or form sell the property or destroy the property of another individual, I surely cannot do so in the case of, well, it's in my body, so it's my choice. No, doesn't work that way. It's not how it works at all. Just because your softball comes over your fence and lands in my yard, I don't become the owner of the softball. It's still your softball. I can say all day, well, it's on my yard, therefore it's mine. Legally, it's not mine. It is theirs. Now, I could file a criminal complaint and say that they trespassed or they damaged my property, and I could demand reparations for whatever their softball did. But their softball is still not my softball. So no matter how we paint this picture from a legal perspective, there is no grounds at all for those arguments. And not only are there no grounds at all, but there are far, far more strict rules and laws and regulations surrounding much lower biological beings than that of a human. Now, there's a flip side to this whole issue. Because whether we acknowledge that a child from the moment of conception is a living life or is a non-living human biologic, whatever you want to call it, okay? It's a fetus, as they would refer to it, okay? Either way, this is going to come down to an argument of life or property. There's no in-between on that. And you have to keep in mind, what are the implications of allowing a child to be murdered, to be aborted by a mother due to the desire for that to be carried out? Because essentially the big push behind this is, well, little Sue Sally got in the back seat of a Corvette and with some dude and shouldn't have, and now she's pregnant, and that's going to ruin her cheerleading career, that's going to ruin her college, it's going to ruin her life. This kind of nonsense is usually the arguments that are made. And a lot of the time that the approach to that is, well, when's their heartbeat, or well, when is their sentience, well, when is their this or that or whatever. And essentially we try to diminish those things down to, well, what can the child do that's human-like? And you're going to put yourself in a very dangerous situation when you start to say, well, the less normal human behavior that this biological entity can carry out, the less humanity it has, which means that we finally reach a point that we will deem it as being alive but not human. Well, we can do that on the flip side of the spectrum. I'm a pastor. I go in and out of hospitals a lot. I have a much older congregation. I see diseases such as dementia. I see diseases such as comatose. I see diseases such as vegetative states. I see all kinds of things begin to slowly happen to the aged of our nation on a regular basis. You could make the same arguments for killing Grandma Sally that you could for aborting a child. Because when you have a Grandma Sue who's 95 years old and her tongue's hanging out of her head and she can't talk, she can't walk, she can't move, she's sitting there on a machine, that then you have every right, according to what abortion laws would state would allow you to carry out an abortion, to kill Grandma Sue. Now, I am sure that if you're on here and you have a grandma, I'm sure that you'll love her dearly. And the idea that I could just walk into her hotel or to her hospital bedroom or into her nursing home room or into her hospice room and just pull the plug whenever I please because, I mean, she's not sentient. She's not getting to do any of the things that other humans can do. Therefore, she no longer qualifies as human. I'm sure you'd be hoping that I'd be charged to the fullest extent of the law with, at minimum, negligent homicide. At the minimum. Well, why would you call that a homicide? The same ideas that are being pushed to prove that an abortion is legally okay, and not only is it legally okay, but that it should be considered reasonable and rational and good for society for us to participate and legislate such an activity. Why would you have a problem with me doing that with Sue? Grandma Sue sitting there in the nursing home. Isn't she better off dead than in the state she's in? So you have to think about that when anytime there is a law brought forward, there is always an implicit reaction to that law. A law that allowed for the murdering of a child for an abortion at any given point after the moment of conception would in fact have a reverse flip consequence of that law even having the ability to be expanded out into justifying homicides against people that are mentally disabled, against people who are in vegetative or a comatose state, against people who are in a position of dementia. There's all kinds of things that would open a door to. This is no different than with homosexuality that we talked about last week of this is not even beyond the biblical principle of the fact that God says that that is not only abominable, but that it's wrong and that it is inherently sinful. When you undo the line of a marriage being defined as a man and a woman coming together with a goal of having children, rearing a family that is going to be a God-honoring family for me personally, but at least a family of good morality and of good citizenship if you're lost and you don't agree with me on the religious aspect of this. Anytime you take it beyond that point, you erase the line and you say, well, no, a homosexual union is equal to that of a traditional marriage. Where can you draw the line? Because the moment you say a man and a man can have a union, or a woman and a woman can have a union, you cannot draw a line and say, well, a man and a child can't have a union. You go, oh, well, of course we can. No, you cannot, because the basis for your union of a man and a man or a woman is that they love each other. They are consenting and they love each other. Which means that a man and a child, or a woman and a child, who love each other and are consenting, whether the child's able to understand that or not, well, they can have a union. Oh, well, now a man and a woman, or a man and a animal, or a woman and an animal, you have the same thing. Oh, well, they love each other. The dog rolled over and allowed the activity to be taken care of. They are consenting. And a lot of people listen to this and they, oh, that's crazy. Oh, that's crazy. That would never happen. It already is. It already is. My wife wrote a sociology paper about 10 years ago about how if we allowed this to be legislated with homosexual marriage, that it would lead to those kinds of things. We've had governors and their men in West Virginia running for the governorship of that state over the last 8 years, whose agenda was to push pedophilic marriages. There were people that were pushing bestiality marriages. Even on groups such as the Young Turks, one of the main guys that's on there said that he would allow bestiality to a point if he was ever elected as president, because you can't make an argument against it in light of the decision of homosexuality. It's already happening. It's all coming true. All the crazy people, all the people who say, well, this is the implicit reaction of this legislation, they're right. And it's no different with abortion. If we take any aspect of a moment after conception, whether it's a day or it's 16 weeks, where we have the ability to take a life, the only argument that we can make for taking that life is whether or not it can perform what we deem to be sentient or human. And that is going to have a negative reaction on the other end of the scope, where now, instead of life being inherently a good thing, we are now deeming what makes a life a good thing or not, which puts many other people at risk, whether people realize that or not. Now, here's the overall civic answer to the problem of abortion. 98% of abortion cases are due to Sally Sue getting in the backseat of a Corvette with Mr. Brent, the quarterback of the football team, and them deciding they're going to have a 5-minute showdown and the worst 15 seconds of her life. And bada bing, bada boom, we have a child. That is what happens 98% of abortion cases. And so the civic answer to this problem is teaching people to accept responsibility for their actions. Whether we like it or not, yeah, little Sally Sue and Mr. Brent may have just messed up the ease of a college career. They may have just messed up the ease of going through high school and graduating. They may have just messed up the future unions, because not all, pretty much every one of these unions does not end in the two individuals being married. And even if it does, most of the time it then ends up in a divorce within 2 to 3 years after it's happened. We already know the longevity of this kind of an issue is not much, which means, yes, it's probably going to cause strain on future marriages. It's going to cause strain on future children that they're going to have within those marriages. That is a consequence of your actions. There is no law, no piece of legislation that exists at all within the United States to negate responsibility. They are all there to enforce responsibility and consequences of actions. Which means that there's no reason in the world that we should say, yeah, abortion should be allowed, because how is Sue going to cheerlead? Quite frankly, I don't care if Sue can cheerlead or not. Sue made a decision. We live in a day and time that there are numerous contraceptives. There are numerous ways to avoid getting a pregnancy. There is the old school way of avoiding a pregnancy for a man with even a slightest iota of self-control. Then I'm not even talking about abstinence either, which would be my Christian response to it of, if you do not partake in that activity before you're married, you don't have to worry about it. I'll even take that one off the table and say that there is all kinds of ways for this to not happen. And the only way that this can happen is if you allow it to happen. You partake in an activity that will lead to it, or you decide that you're going to do it anyway and hope that maybe it won't happen. The best way to answer this question or to solve this problem is that we teach you accept responsibility for your actions. You don't get to have a magic pill that erases all of your decisions because you made foolish decisions. I've got plenty of things in my past I wish I could change. I can't change them. They are what they are. And you bear the responsibility of those decisions. And the other reason for enforcing that is, whether we like it or not, children make for better adults. When my wife and I first got married, we had a perfect marriage in all sense of the fashion. We didn't argue very much. We didn't have any major fights. There was no, oh, I'm going to divorce you. There was no any of that nonsense. We had to go through many, many tough challenges together. And we made each other better. And I would argue that our child has made us better than either two of us could have ever made each other. Because a child brings with it responsibility and suffering and growing up and maturity, all things that people need. And in this day and time, I would argue need them a little bit younger because they're not being raised to be adults. They're being raised to be children. So when we're looking at a civic response to this question, the civic response, the right response, is not that we allow for the killing of a child. It's that we teach responsibility, or we teach intelligent decision making, and we enforce the consequences of those decisions if you make them, and we allow what nature to take its course. And for these two individuals to have a child and to have to learn the hard way about responsibility and to have to learn the hard way about accepting consequences for your actions and having to learn the hard way that life is a lot more difficult when you do it the dumb way. That's the reality of the situation. And I know that there's probably some of you on here that you go, well, you don't understand. I had a cousin. This happened with her. The guy abandoned her. Yes, I see that all the time. I have that own story with my own niece. That my niece made the same foolish decision. She's put herself in a very tough spot. And I'm going to tell you right now that even being in that tough spot, there were tons of people who stepped up to help her with that situation. And quite frankly, her attitude and her behavior has not gotten better despite the foolishness of her decisions and despite those that are helping her out because they're making excuses for her about her decisions instead of allowing her to take the fullness of those consequences. When you take away consequences of bad decisions from people, that makes for a bad culture. It makes for a bad citizen. It makes for a bad nation. So that's the civic side of this. Now let's get to the one that I actually care about and the one that matters the most. And that is the biblical one of why in the world is it that Christians have a problem with abortion? Well, we have a problem with abortion. Bible has a problem with abortion. God has a problem with abortion for a multiplicity of reasons. First of all, we are all made in God's image, which is a very, very important and profound biblical teaching. In Genesis chapter 1 and verses 26 through 27, it said, God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Now, in chapter 2 of Genesis, we get a little bit of a deeper picture of what it is that God does here. And it says that he breathed life into Adam, that he formed and molded Adam, which means that when God is talking about making men and women here in his image, this is a very personal thing. This is a very powerful thing. And it speaks to the fact that we are not like anything else on this planet. My dog does not have a soul. My dog is not made in the image of God. I might really like my dog. He's a lot of fun. He's a great dog. He's trying to go hunting with me. He's a little ADHD for that. We're working on it. He's a great dog. But my dog's not made in the image of God. God didn't take the time to use his own hands to fashion my dog. But he did do that to fashion me and to fashion you and to fashion every single human being and soul that has ever lived, is living now, and ever will live in the future. God has taken a personal step in creating man. And the idea that we're made in his image, and there's some speculation as to how to properly define this, but the easiest way to understand it is that we are just like God. We're a three-part being. We're physical, spiritual, and emotional or rational, whichever the one you want to pick. You can pick emotional or rational. It'll all cover the same grounds. And what that means is that we are formed in the same way that God is formed. We have a conscience. We have a moral thought process. We have the ability to understand and to seek out very complex, higher concepts than just that of food, water, bathroom, procreate, okay? Which is all about pretty much what goes through an animal's mind. We think of higher things, of more moral things, of legal things, of philosophical things. When you look at humanity compared to any other biological being on the planet, you're not going to observe the complexities that exist within humanity. You're not going to observe it. Nowhere at all. Even if you want to hop over to science saying that, you know, your closest cousin is the gorilla and the monkey and all these guys. And yes, I'm not one of those pastors that thinks that I came from a monkey. I totally understand. Macroevolution has the idea that I am the cousin or uncle to the monkey, depending on which one you're talking to, all right? When we go to that conversation, even within primates, you don't see a higher understanding or a philosophical understanding of their world. They don't have that at all. They will eat each other if it comes down to it. We as humanity understand that, no, it's not ever right to beat the tar out of somebody on the street because they walked in your front yard. We have the idea that, no, it's not okay to just murder somebody because they looked at your girlfriend cross-eyed or your wife cross-eyed. Those are all things that occur amongst primates. There's no form of higher thinking amongst them. Even if you could say that they can pick up and do things similar to what we can do, they're not made in the image of God. You being made in the image of God shows that you have a spiritual component, and according to hereditary depravity, which is a very fancy way of saying that you're a sinner by nature, that spiritual side of you is dead from the moment that you're born because you by nature seek to do evil. And that has to be revived and restored by God when you're saved, meaning that you recognize that you need a personal Savior, that you're in need of salvation, that Jesus Christ came to die for your sins, and that He paid that penalty in full through His death, burial, and resurrection, and now has made a way for you to seek for forgiveness of those sins and to be made into a new being. So you're spiritual, you're physical, and then you are rational and emotional. You have feelings, you have higher ideas. These are all things that are unique to humanity. The second thing that God talks about, and what we know about God's opinion of this, occurs multiple times in the Psalms. But we're going to explicitly talk about Psalm 139, verse 13 through 17. David writes and says, "For thou hast possessed my reins, thou hast covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well. My substance was not hid from thee when I was made in secret, and curiously wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Thine eyes did see my substance, yet being unperfect, and in thy book all my members were written, which in continuance were fashioned, when as they yet were as none of them. How precious also are thy thoughts unto me, O God." So what is that saying? What in the world does that mean? If I'm going to give you that in plain, easy to understand English, what David is saying here is that God was with David from the moment that he was conceived, that he was indeed 100% a living life. In fact, a better translation, a more modern English translation of this passage is, "You made all the delicate inner parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb." That's verse 13. "Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your marksmanship is marvelous. How well I know it." Verse 14. "You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the dark of the womb." That's verse 15. "You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed." That's verse 16. "How precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered." What is David telling you? What is David telling you about God? What is David telling you about the position that God takes on life? That it starts at conception. And this is not the only place. when we go throughout the Bible, we see these same concepts all throughout the Psalms. In Psalm 70, the writer of Psalm 70, it's either Psalm 70 or Psalm 71. My brain's not working with me at the moment. But I believe it is Psalm 70, though. The writer of Psalm 70, who we do not know, is reflecting over his life and God's involvement in it. Essentially, he's an older man, or even potentially maybe an older woman, we don't know. But an older man who's looking back over his life, and he is talking about the fact that God has been with him every step of the way. And he says, "You were with me in my mother's womb. You were with me at my birth." Meaning that God's influence over this child, this man's life, happened long before he even could know who God was, because God was there protecting and developing and nurturing him from the moment of conception. That is taught over and over and over again in Old and New Testament alike, that there is in no way, shape, or form an argument that says God does not acknowledge human life as starting with conception. Now, the question that I get to that, though, is people say, well, if that's truly the case, why does the Bible not explicitly discuss abortion? To which my answer is the same as it was with the civic side of it. Because the argument that abortion is wrong is implicit in the details of the Bible. In Psalm 127, verse 3, that whole psalm is about how children are a blessing to God. In Exodus 21, verses 22 through 25, we are having the layout of the law, the beginnings of the fashioning of the Levitical law that, of course, we see in the book of Leviticus, which precedes the book of Exodus. Well, we're looking in there, that whole passage of verses 22 through 25 deals with the issue of if two men get into a fight and a woman is injured, a pregnant woman is injured in that fight, and she's caused to have a birth prematurely. It's wrongly translated that she has a miscarriage. The idea is that she has a premature birth as a result of an injury that occurred during these two men fighting with one another, that you are to render to that situation the payment of whatever damage was caused, whatever financial liability was caused, assuming there's no physical injury, by the way, that the man who caused the injury to the woman would pay the husband of that woman whatever the price was of whatever happened. Because if you have a premature birth, assuming the child, of course, lives through a premature birth, especially in the day and time in which that was written, that child would immediately have special needs. That family would immediately have the financial burden of a child they were not prepared for yet. And so that price would be paid for. However, that verse goes on to say, however, if there is injury, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, life for a life. Meaning that if the mother or the child was harmed physically, that same amount of injury is to be placed on that individual. Or if the mother or the child or both are to die, then the punishment would be for the individual who caused that murder, that homicide, whether it be negligent or not. They would be put to death. Meaning that God is acknowledging, even in the womb, that this is indeed a living human being. And that if that life is killed in any way, shape, or form, even if it's through the negligent actions of two men fighting, they are to be put to death, whichever one caused the injury, caused the problem. So there is constant text in the Bible that abortion is implicit. And the reason it's implicit is because it's not something we should even have to discuss. Do you understand the level of cultural, sinful evil that has to occur for a society to begin talking about whether or not it's okay to kill kids? That the rational cesspool that you have to descend into to even be having this discussion is astoundingly evil. I can never think of a time as a child that we ever talked about whether or not it was okay to kill kids. Never happened. There was no debate about it. There was no talking about it. It wasn't even thought of in any way, shape, or form. That was only 27 years ago. So for us to have already descended to where we are, where we're trying to look for loopholes in the Bible to justify these kinds of actions, not only is it blatantly made clear in the laws regarding life and how God views the moment of conception of a human being, but even inside these laws that deal with children that are still within the womb, it is very clear that God views them as alive. In fact, God had a huge problem with the Canaanites, did he not, in the Old Testament? And one of the gods who he explicitly talked about being an abomination to him was the Canaanite god known as Molech. Molech was a vicious god. He was a god that they would offer their children as sacrifices, and they offered their children in a horrific way to this god. They would take a metal statue that was formed in the image of this particular idolatrous god. I would call it a demon, personally. And they would place this statue in the middle of a fire. And they would heat that statue until it is what's called in the blacksmithing world, red hot. Meaning that there's a point at which you can heat metal that the metal itself will glow red. And it is at that moment that they would place children from newborn to even upwards of 5 and 6 years old, according to some historical text, alive on the hands of this red-hot metal altar. And they would beat drums to drown out the screaming as the child burned to death. And did not burn to death, by the way, in a normal light them on fire way. It is literally a melting, burning them kind of death. It is the worst kind of death you can think of. It's very similar to the bronze bull that was a form of torture back in the days of the Greeks and the Persians. That they would build a fire underneath it, and then they would throw a man in alive to literally be convection oven cooked. That's the idea of what would happen with this particular god. And God destroyed the Canaanites over it. He ordered the death of all of them over it. He talked explicitly multiple times in various texts throughout the Old Testament about his disdain and his horrid hatred for this particular idolatrous worship. Idolatrous worship that Solomon brought back into the kingdom under his reign, that God punished all of Judah for. So even in the text, anywhere that children are killed or viewed as lesser than, throughout all of the biblical narrative, God deals with it very, very viciously. It's not something that he views lightly. So we know that we're made in the image of God, which means that our life has very great intrinsic value. We're made in the image of God. We know that God knows us from the womb, from the moment of conception, which means that God views you as a living being the moment that sperm meets egg. We know that abortion can be seen implicitly in many of the other commandments that exist throughout the Old Testament and things that God ordered the destruction of throughout the Old Testament. But we also have the point that we are charged numerous times in the Old and especially in the New Testament to protect the least of these. In Psalm 72, Solomon's talking about judging righteously the people of God, even the poor. And he says that over and over again, even the poor. When he gets down into verses 8 and 9 of that particular psalm, and I'm going to paraphrase this because it's not in front of me, but Solomon says that he's going to set up great mountains to bring peace to the people and little hills to judge righteously the people. He's talking about different levels of government that are going to exist in his monarchy so that he can better rule the people. And he says so that they can deal righteously for those that are needy, for those that are poor, and to break those that are the oppressor. Meaning that we're told time and time again in the Old Testament and in the New Testament by Jesus Christ himself that we are supposed to help those and protect those who cannot help and protect themselves. And And children fall 100% under that category, especially when God views them from the moment of conception as being a human life. That's not a debatable thing with God. But there is one other reason. And the other reason is that the biblical writers, the men who were used by God to write the biblical texts that we have, they all believed this 110%. In Jeremiah chapter 1, right off the bat, if you don't know anything about Jeremiah, he's known as the weeping prophet. He was called by God to go and to preach the message of truth to Israel, even though he was told that he would preach to them and they would never believe him. They would never change, they'd never repent, and they'd be destroyed. He does that for 40 years, preaches to Israel, trying to convince them to do the right thing. And right out of the beginning, he tells Jeremiah in chapter 1, verse 5, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." God tells Jeremiah explicitly, before you were ever formed in the belly, meaning conceived, before you were ever even conceived and developed in the womb, I knew you. Before you were birthed out of the womb, I knew how you would do this work for me. And I ordained you a prophet unto the nations well before you were born. Meaning that God knew, because God is God, that Jeremiah would come to a saving knowledge of God. And remember, in the Old Testament, they had faith looking forward. We have faith looking backward on the completed work of Christ. He knew that he would be saved. He knew that he would have a relationship with God. And God knew exactly how he was going to use Jeremiah, even before he was conceived. Meaning that God views them as a life well before you and I even know they're going to exist, which is an amazing thing. And Paul says likewise in the New Testament. If you go to the book of Galatians, where Paul is talking to the church at Galatia, talking to them about things that are going on. This is where famous passages such as the fruit of the Spirit occur. Right off the bat in chapter 1 of Galatians in verse 15, Paul tells us about God. He says, "But when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace." What is Paul saying? Paul is saying that from the moment I was conceived, God knew how he was going to use me. God knew what he was going to do with my life. That's an amazing lesson, because if you're here and you're a child of God, you're a Christian, and you even remotely think that abortion is okay, you need to leave whatever church you're attending that's teaching you that that's okay, because it's not of God. The men who wrote the Bible, the men who probably will always know the Bible better than any of us today who study it, didn't even agree with it. They agreed that a life happens at the moment of the womb, and not only that it happens, but that God knows who it is, who it's going to be, and what's going to come of their lives, and how he can use them if they give their lives to him. That's an astounding lesson. We know that from the scriptures we're made in the image of God, which immediately places a high value on every human life, whether that's the heroin addict in the ditch, the richest man in the world, or a newly conceived child. There's no debate that all have high value to God and that all are made in the image of God. There's no debate with God that abortion is implicitly discussed, but also, I would even argue, is explicitly shown to be something that God's people should not even remotely be okay with nor approve of. And finally, because we are charged to protect those who cannot protect themselves and to help those who cannot help themselves. Now, if you're on here and that final thrust is not your cup of tea, you're on here and you're coming from the place of politics or logic or science. There's more than ample evidence the science already proves what God says is true. And there's already ample evidence that to legislate such a thing in any way, shape, or form, and to carry it out to its fullest, would be destructive, unreasonable, irrational, and quite frankly, bad for any given society who would adopt such a practice. So, what's the answer to that? We have a problem with abortion because abortion is spiritually, rationally, and scientifically evil. And there is no good that will come out of it. There's nothing right that will come out of it. In fact, it will lead to nothing but further rot and decay of our culture and of our society and of our world as a whole. And so that is the answer to the very hotly debated, very highly argued concept of abortion, and specifically the answer to the question of why is it that Christians have an issue with abortion. If you're on here, I appreciate you being on here, staying on through the whole thing. I know this is one of the longer ones. We try to keep it within the realm of an hour. Sometimes we get into an hour and a half-ish, sometimes an hour and 45. That only happened one time, though, so don't get scared. But I hope that all of you have an excellent week. If you're on here and you didn't agree with anything that I said, I hope that I at least made some points and some arguments that would help to change your mind a little bit, give you something to chew on or think about. As always, a quick reminder, we've kind of changed the format of how we do this podcast. We are answering these questions from a long list that I've contrived over the last couple of years, of talking to people that are saved, who are struggling to study the Bible, and people who are not saved, who have questions about the Bible. But if you have any questions, or you have any comments, or you want to debate any of those points, you can leave that in the comment section. I will send you an email address. Shoot me an email about whatever your questions are. I'll answer those questions, but then we'll discuss them on the show too as well, because if you have that question, I promise you somebody else does. If you have an argument or something that you want to make, I'm more than willing to discuss it with everybody. Now, I am a full-time pastor and a full-time father and a full-time husband and a full-time a whole lot of other things, well beyond just this. So it may take me a little bit to get back with you if we're having a discussion back and forth, but I'll have that conversation with you, and we'll talk about it even further in depth than what we talked about here. But we hope that everyone that's on here has an excellent week. Any of you who come in later this week, listen to the recording, I hope you have an excellent week. Pray for all of you, even though we only know your usernames. I hope that everybody has a very, very, very good week this week. That God blesses you, gives you opportunities to serve Him if you're on here and a child of God. And if you're on here and you're lost, I hope that going through the podcast, you'll come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, make some decisions that will forever change your life for the better. And as always, you guys get out of here and go study.